Konnichiwa, everyone. This is Brett. Today is January 5th. I hope your new year is still going well. You might remember from the last show, I wished you a happy one. This show, self-explanatory, a Q&A, Q for questions, A for answers. Bill Buepert is the guest. It's a follow-up to our Stoicism series. One announcement, though, before we get started. This Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, the fourth episode. No, that's too weak a word. The fourth occurrence of Podcast Masters, Liberty Masterclass. We're going to be having a discussion about film censorship inspired by the recent events with Sony Pictures Entertainment and the Seth Rogen picture, The Interview. So I hope you'll check us out, coolsucksproject.com/live, and we'd love to have your participation. All right, thanks. And ladies and gentlemen, the Scorpions, huh? Yeah! All right. I love listener Q&A. I don't get to do it enough on the show, but I've asked people for suggestions, for questions, for things that we could discuss. Most of them, almost all of them, relate to what we've discussed with Stoicism, Bill.
Great.
So,
and if they're not, so what?
So the first question was asked by a listener named Justin and another listener named Kevin, and I'm just going to read Kevin's version. In the first episode, I believe you said you would discuss Stoicism and how home education fits into the way of life. I would be curious to hear this discussion if time permits.
Stoicism and home education, I think, are married to each other, and I don't think this is a notion of rationalization. When we examine Stoicism, as we have over these four parts, we've discovered that not only is it simple, not only is it elegant, but it speaks to a way in which you are the captain of your own life, quite literally. And that's what you want to do with home education. And by the way, Brett, I love the bifurcation you made between homeschooling and home education. I've taken it upon myself to make sure I practice using that phrase instead of homeschooling when I tell people that's what we've done. Home education means that you never extinguish a love of learning, nor not grant your students in your house, your family or whoever they may be, the ability to have all the tools at their disposal to think critically. And I just think Stoicism matches up with that really nicely. The counterfactual that we would employ in history is we'd say, well, why didn't that event take place and why wouldn't it be like this? So using that kind of taxonomy when I'm examining Stoicism in home education, I can't find anything in Stoicism that doesn't augment or champion home education as an endeavor.
Do you feel like as you were going through the home education process, and I know you said that your wife did a lot of the work, would you have considered yourself a Stoic going all the way back?
Absolutely. And my wife is not completely on board with Stoicism because she still retains some of the prejudices against it as being unemotional and Vulcan and such. But I'm proud to say that all of my sons have become practicing Stoics.
And how do you think that happened? I mean, what did you do to introduce them to that? Or what discussions did you have? And I know that could be a huge subject right there, but if there's any highlights.
Oh, sure. We discuss philosophy all the time. We discuss history together. And of course, I want to give my wife full credit for doing the lion's share of the home education because I was out killing things and bringing them home.
Yeah.
Because that was we were that very unique family setup where she was a homemaker until last year, and she was involved in my children's lives while I was at work for the most part.
Sure.
But it was a nice division of resources and skill sets that we had, and she just excelled at it. I guess the way I can really say that it took was that my eldest son is in the habit of giving Marcus Aurelius's Meditations to both family and friends for a gift. And he speaks to that all the time, and he reminds his younger siblings in their times of peril or inconvenience that the obstacle is away, and that if you use a Stoic sensibility to approach life, you're going to find that you're going to be much happier than you would be otherwise. So I think it has had a big influence, maybe as almost an underwater current in the greater river of homeschooling that we've used, to use a tortured metaphor?
It seems like it would. Yeah. I mean, I've always said on the show, and I probably didn't originate this quote, that learning is living. Living is learning. You know, learning
Agreed.
Is not school. So when somebody is able to orient his or herself around this idea that education happens everywhere, that it can happen all the time, that the world is a learning opportunity, I feel like the mind is more switched on. I mean, I remember at 3 o'clock every afternoon, my mind would switch off. I would be watching MTV and eating popsicles, you know, and that was my evening. And then I had to crank it back up for an hour to do homework later. But I didn't see the learning opportunity that was life, that just was the world around me. And I think that's so powerful once you change your attitude about what education really is.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that if your education stops once you've graduated from a government school, then the government school has achieved what it set out to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm also just a side note here. I'm reminded of this Marcus Aurelius quote. You mentioned meditations. You said your son gives it to people as a gift.
He does.
This would have been great to work into the leadership discussion. I shall meet with meddling, ungrateful, violent, treacherous, envious, and unsociable people, he supposedly told himself every morning upon awakening.
That is just hilarious.
Well,
to me.
It's a good kind of negative visualization that I think a leader should do, right? So you're not just managing and reacting to all of the inconveniences and misfortunes that happen. I keep thinking about it, I guess, in a professional context, leadership versus management. But that is a valuable preparation one might do, I guess, depending on the industry in which they work.
You know, I do want to make a single corrective to something that I said earlier, and you heard me say something to the effect of working towards perfection. And I may have misspoke when I said that, because I do think it's good to work towards perfection, but don't ever assume that you will get it, because I happen to think that perfection is the enemy of the good. And there's this Japanese notion of wabi-sabi.
Mm-hmm.
It's a comprehensive worldview on the acceptance of transience and imperfection. And I think it's very stoic at its core that you accept that while you may seek perfection, not everybody around you is doing the same thing. So I just want to make sure that no one was under the impression that I think that living a perfect life is possible, because I think in this mortal coil, that's impossible.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge demand to put on yourself and, of course, on others, because people are always screwing up my quest for perfection, you know, for sure. And, you know, when you said that, we were talking about hero dreams of sushi. Even changing it to something like accomplishment would be very meaningful to me, I think.
I think so, too. I just think I've always been attracted to Japanese sensibilities, whether it's Japanese art, Japanese gardens, some of these sensibilities about making the most simple the most important. And I think Steve Jobs embraced that Japanese sensibility in American business to a certain extent.
Yeah. How so?
Well, I'm an Apple guy, so I have an iMac. I have a MacBook Pro. My wife has an iPad. She has an iPhone. And there's a real elegance and simplicity in the form and function of Apple products that I've come to appreciate. Like when you go to an Apple store, they go out of their way not to be crowded, not with humans, but not to be crowded with mechanisms,
sure.
Not to be crowded in very simple and alluring colors, basic wooden frameworks. And I'm very attracted to that kind of uncluttered elegance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think and there may be Stoics out there who like cluttered elegance, and I happen to be attracted to the more simple variety among them.
Sure, absolutely. I agree. We were actually having that conversation at home today about how some area was cleaned, and I said, wow, what a difference, you know, just by like moving paper, like things that had accumulated there, you know, 3 pounds of things, tops, moved, and a different world.
I call it the lifestyle palate cleanser.
I like that.
Yeah.
So just to sum up, as far as that stoicism in home education or stoicism as it relates to home education, both promote authorship over one's own life. And that is tremendously important, of course, to the philosophy of liberty as well.
I couldn't have said it better.
Absolutely.
And yes, I agree that there's a direct confluence with libertarian and, in my case, abolitionist values in stoicism.
Did you ever have, or can you remember any resistance to the study of philosophy and maybe how it would have been overcome in a home educating environment? Because I think it's something, it's important to investigate, but it's obviously counterproductive to force anybody to do anything. So any strategies you use to spark interest?
You know, I've had five children, yeah, and we've had five different learning styles. And our most incredible obstacle and the one that's been the hardest has been our youngest, surprisingly enough, because we are a bookish family, except for my youngest. Now, how have I incentivized learning? What I try to do, and my wife, of course, is one of my children is an aviation buff. So we got him glider lessons. We took him to air and space museums. We got him aviation books. He did modeling. And now he's a mechanical engineer with aerospace interest, but he's not working. He's working in robotics, actually. But I think we were able to incentivize his learning by finding out what really made the light bulb go incandescent over his head. Mm-hmm. And we piled on to that.
Yeah.
And if it was something that he found dull, we try to find a way to convince him or her that I know this seems boring at the time, but all this will nest together nicely with what your ambitions are learning wise.
Absolutely.
Now, but it's imperfect, Brett. I mean, I can't say we've hit a home run with all of our children. For instance, my youngest son, he's become rather resistant. So what we've done is we've done the Scandinavian thing and we've said, well, we're backing off.
Sure.
Because if I press and press and press, I will probably so poison his yen for learning that it may be permanently stunted. And that's the last thing a home educator wants to do, because mission one, job one for all home educators is, well, it's twofold. Number one, instill love of learning. Number two, give them the critical thinking tool set to do number one.
Absolutely. I totally agree. You know, this came up recently on my show. We were talking about crypto archaeology, and I mentioned this program on the so-called History Channel, Ancient Aliens. And I worked with
the Hitler Channel.
Well, it used to be the Hitler Channel. They backed off that for some reason. I mean, that would have been better than what they're doing now. But yeah, Ancient Aliens, and this boy was like 8 or 9, and he was absolutely fascinated with this theory and Eric von Däniken. And you know, I remember like these tense moments for me as a facilitator saying, this isn't good. You know, this can't be somebody's whole educational world. But all I could do was kind of, you know, surf the wave of that momentum and try to create opportunities to think critically, to challenge what he wanted to believe. And it ultimately was very successful. We wound up building like a pictorial representation of the evidence that aliens built the pyramids. And at that point, he was convinced. When we couldn't put any pieces of hard evidence down, and made some distinctions between what's evidence and what is like an anecdote or something that some guy on television said, we realized there wasn't much holding that thesis up. And but, you know, I didn't say that was silly. You know, I wrote it out, and I think it turned out to be an enriching experience, but I was certainly nervous for a while. But the point is that the momentum of the enthusiasm of the learner is super, super important.
It is. And of course, with all these shows like Ancient Aliens and cryptoarchaeology, cryptozoology and conspiracy theories and stuff like that, if it weren't for correlative assumptions versus causative assumptions, they wouldn't be in the business they are.
That's actually a really good point. And we talked about that quite a bit. And obviously, you're really going into a world of mystery, you know, when you go back thousands of years as far as how things happened exactly or why things happened exactly. And I think that makes ancient history very fascinating, but it also makes it pretty frustrating.
And you know what? You don't have to delve into the supernatural to come up with interesting, innovative conclusions. For instance, I was listening to, we took a trip to Utah. We listened to some CDs, mm-hmm. some books on CD. And one of them was about the history of the Vikings. And they were talking about the way Viking technology was so important to give them the kind of pervasive maritime supremacy that they have. If you look at the way they built their ships, for instance, the way they built their ships wasn't from boards, but from whole trees that were laminated together. And you'll notice that on most Viking vessels, which are about 25 meters long, they could ship in a draft of 3 feet or more. And that's awful shallow. But what that means is that they were also brown water vessels and riverine vessels. But because of the design of it, the design was such that you'll notice fore and aft looks identical. The reason for that is that if they beach the boat and they do whatever they do in a raid or whatever the case may be, could be commerce, and they go to leave, they don't have to turn the ship around. They simply shove it out and go.
Yeah.
That's brilliant, elegant, simple technology.
Another interesting thing, too, is that a lot of that stuff is missing from the narrative of history. Like, what was the specific Viking technology or technologies that aided them in the exploring new worlds? Well, they didn't play very well with other people. So there's, you know, a chance that good portions of their history or their knowledge could have been lost or could simply be erased from history. And then there's people like Graham Hancock who have lobbed this idea out there of the possibility of a lost civilization. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. He's not saying the world is explained by this lost civilization or the Atlanteans or anything like that. He's trying to raise questions about what he sees as some blind spots in the mainstream narrative of ancient history.
And sell books.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that too, for sure. But it's an interesting question, like what are understudied areas of known existing ancient civilizations? What technologies might they have had? And how could that be creating this big, you know, you said you don't have to go to the supernatural. You kind of have to want to go there. You know, it kind of has to be you start with a conclusion is what a lot of these people are doing.
Sure.
And even though I think Graham Hancock is pretty far out there on some stuff, I've never got the impression that that's what he was trying to do. He's not being one of those people.
Well, you look at the Romans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You look at the Roman legions, for instance, for almost 1,000 years. They have a global supremacy in arms on the plains, plains.
Mm-hmm.
Not in forests, of course, because we see what Arminius did to the Roman legions when they're separated from their shield wall in the Teutoburg forest. When they had the shield wall, and because of discipline, technology, evolving adaptation to tactics and things like that, when you read Caesar's commentary on Gaul, there was not a time, even when the Gauls were able to unite themselves under one king, in which they were able to militarily defeat the legions, even when they tried to emulate what the legions did, because of the experiential database that informed the shield wall and the tactics that were used. For instance, how could the Romans fight for hours with a shield wall? It's because they had centuriates, optios, legates. They had a very sophisticated system, not only of leadership, but of officership, in which, let's suppose you have a shield wall forward, and it's 5 deep, every 7 to 10 minutes, a whistle would blow for a given legion because they all had their different signifiers, aquifiers, and musicians who would give the different signals for a given legion, let's say 10th from 12th. And what that would mean is relief in place, which means that the guy who's holding up the guy with the shield in front of them, he relieves him instantly.
Mm.
And the guy who was in the front goes 5 deep, and he rests for an hour. That's how they could maintain sieges. That's how they could maintain fights for hours on end. And that's how they could defeat their enemies. It's not superstition. It's not supernatural. It's just plain good organizational technique.
Absolutely. All right. You ready for question number 2?
I am.
All right. Justin asks, will you consider discussing material simplicity in more depth, a Stoic approach to personal finances and minimizing debt burdens?
I would love to discuss all those if you'll remind me of 2 and 3 when I talk about material simplicity.
Sure, absolutely.
I find that material simplicity, and I think we were just covering that a bit when we were talking about Apple and Steve Jobs, and there's probably other corporate or commercial exemplars of that philosophy out there. Like, one thing that fascinates me, being a member of the Apple subculture, and I have to put out this full disclosure, I'm a member of the Apple subculture because I am not a cyber ninja. I'm a technological idiot.
Mm.
And I find that the intuitive nature of Apple products speaks to my lack of sophistication in computers. So that being the case, I look at all the periphery stuff that is offered out there, all these companies that have really made their vig as a result of Apple products. For instance, I have a MacBook Pro, and there's this very elegantly designed stand that's like 6 inches high, and that's angled towards me, that I put my MacBook on, and then I put a keyboard in front of it, and I open the MacBook, and I could do it comfortably so that I'm not leaning forward. Because when you lean your neck forward, let's say 4 to 6 inches, when you're looking down at a keyboard or looking down at something, you're putting an order of magnitude or 300% more stress on those top seven bones of your neck than you would be when your neck is erect. So not only is it simple, but it's healthy for me to use, but it's just a piece of aluminum metal when you look at it, but it's so elegantly constructed, like my iMac. I think it's very elegantly constructed. To me, that embraces material simplicity. There's a design ethos out there, and I don't think it's Bauhaus because it's a little simpler than that, where angularity and simple lines and simple colors and things like that blend to make for really attractive aesthetics. And as I said before, the Japanese really excel at that.
Yeah. For me, it's just a less chaotic world that it produces.
It is. Material simplicity, I think what Justin may be speaking to also is not only the material simplicity of the tools we use to improve our lives, but the material simplicity of not having as many tools. And I would say that a Stoic virtue is that the largest house you build is probably the house of your mind and not the one that surrounds you on a daily basis.
Mm. He also wanted us to tie in personal finances and minimizing debt burdens.
What a great topic. And Stoicism speaks to that in simplicity of lifestyle, knowing that in the end, we come into the world naked and we leave the world naked on a slab. And whatever toys and everything else we've accumulated, once we're on our deathbed and hopefully surrounded by friends and family at the time, if it dictates that, we're not going to lay there and say, oh man, and my wife reminds me of this. We're not going to lay there and say, oh, I wish I could have driven more cars, or I wish I could have owned more houses, or we're going to look around and into the faces of all the people surrounding us. And the most likely answer we'll have if we're virtuous in my mind, and I have to constantly practice this, is what could I have done to spend more quality time with them? What could I have done to make my life more simple, where I am not so distracted by the baubles, where I forget what's most important in life, which is the experience?
Yeah, I remembered, I basically grew up in my professional life in Vermont, where life is very simple. Everything is very affordable. I had good work out there. I wanted for pretty much nothing. And in 2006, I moved to like the greater Boston area, and suddenly I was making a lot more money, and I was very ill prepared for this change. I was involved in a relationship at the time with a girl who also was ill-prepared for this change, and our standard of living immediately rose to meet or exceed our new incomes. And I just remember, like, you know, getting a new car and moving into this condo and being so nervous all the time. Like, I was going to lose it, this standard of living. But everything I was doing, when I think about like how much I enjoyed my day-to-day operations related to work, everything I was doing was just to maintain this tenuous standard of living that I had somehow suddenly achieved just by, a geographic shift.
That's fascinating. And, you know, Seneca would ask us, he would say, so you've got all this, but what do you have?
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
His question would be, so you've surrounded yourself with this, and what percentage of your waking hours are consumed in maintaining the debt necessary to sustain what you've surrounded yourself with in bubbles?
I remember it was around this time, too, that I got my first one of the smart purchases that I made at this time was I got an iPod, and I had never had one before. I was a tutor, so work was slow in the non-school year time. And I had been working in the summers when I was a teacher just as a painter, which is like the best work if you can get it. I mean, you're outside. If you can set up the right gig and you're working for the right people, or you're working for yourself, you're outside in beautiful weather by yourself with audiobooks and podcasts. I mean, and the pay isn't that bad. And it was around this time that, you know, I got into Free Talk Live and then a host of other Liberty themed podcasts, and I had kind of walked away from one schooling world and into another one. And I started to really put everything together. And it felt like in this grind, suddenly life started to have some meaning again, or meaning maybe for the first time. I remember I was just racing to catch a train and then riding a train and running through Boston to get to some library or some college to meet with some group of people. And in my ears, I had these ideas. And I was hearing them for the first time, and suddenly, like, all that stuff, it just didn't seem as important anymore. Not that, you know, being comfortable in life and having a decent standard of living aren't priorities for me, but suddenly I was awakened to something new. And that just made a huge difference in how I operated and what my goals were and how my goals shifted. It was quite an experience.
Well, you know, we're doing a constant reassessment in my household because I've had some peak earning years, and this is not such a peak earning year, this past one. Mm-hmm. And we've had to make adjustments and such, but you can make the adjustments and it really makes you reassess and reappraise what's critically important and what isn't. So, and as far as debt is concerned, being in debt simply, and I'm not a Christian, but it's hard for me to do better than the Ten Commandments, but it's also hard for me to do better than some of the quotations in there. And I'm paraphrasing here. I think it was Leviticus that said that if you are in debt, you are a slave to the lender.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction to make. And not only are you, in this case, to fast forward to the 21st century, you're a slave to fashion. And if you're a slave to fashion, fashion is conformity, and you're a slave to conformity. That's something you have to manage. But just remember, there's fine print, and you sign for every debt that you have. One thing that really makes my head explode, Brett, is on occasion I'll see on Twitter or elsewhere a person holding up a handwritten sign, which seems to be a wave right now, that says, I have my master's degree in women's studies and I'm $160,000 in debt. And my response is usually, you can't show me one student out there who didn't sign for the loan that they have. Not one.
Right.
So this thing with debt, the very Stoic perspective of debt is that if you've got it, you own it because you signed for it.
Right.
And that you should avoid it. Seneca would tell you to avoid it.
Yeah. And when we mentioned this before, I talked about what the blind spots would be for somebody in that position, like right out of high school. Now, I agree with what you're saying. Kind of thinking it would be interesting for you to debate somebody like, who did I talk to recently? I don't know. It would be a debate. Maybe it would be more of a discussion. Jeff Berwick was talking about student loans. And he's like, oh, just leave the country. Pretty much.
To get over, because they can't be discharged with bankruptcy.
Right.
I mean, they follow you everywhere. But even if you I suspect that you would be subject to student loans in the same way you're subject to taxation until you renounce your U.S. citizenship.
Yeah. So I completely agree with the idea of honoring your debts. I know there might be some 19 or 20 year olds or even people. Gosh, I mean, I guess today you could be 45 and still plagued with this student loan problem.
Indeed.
Saying, well, you know, I don't really know how I feel, they might be saying, about this specific kind of debt.
You know, I'm a recovering homeowner.
Yeah.
You know, for the longest time, I bought into that silliness where they said that owning a home is the American dream and it's the thing you should do. I wish I could have all that money back right now. I'm a renter and I'm very happy.
I've never had any ambition. I always just saw it as a tie down. And
that's exactly what it is.
And I've seen some beautiful homes. You know, I go and visit friends and they've made these wonderful homes, but it's never been suited to my lifestyle. And I guess that could change, but I've just never. I remember when I lived in Vermont and I was a teacher, I had a pretty stable job and I was making plenty of money for the Vermont economy. And the director of the school I worked at, he was saying, you know, you got to buy a house, Brett. You got to just go out and buy a house. I'm like, I make $34,000 a year. Where am I going to buy a house? And he's like, no. And so what year is this? Just for a little context, 2004, 2005, 2006.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. And he's like, no, Brett, they'll give you a house. They'll do it. Just go get a house. And there were houses in this town. I lived in Bennington, Vermont. There were houses for like 50 grand. But I knew that even if I could do it, and back then with that income in that place, I probably could have done it. I probably could have been a homeowner in Bennington, Vermont. But where would I be right now?
Well, you missed the bullet.
That's true.
Quite literally, you did.
Yeah, yeah. No, he kept saying that to me. Brett, this is a buyer's market. It's a great time. The opportunities are... I'm glad I didn't. And, you know, if I had the same opportunities today, I don't know. I just don't have any desire to do it.
Nor do I. And I urge my children, you know, not only if you have the chance to get out of your U.S. citizenship, do so, but don't buy a house in America.
Absolutely. I agree. All right. Third question. This is a bit of a touchy one. I'm going to read it in its entirety. And, you know, you can choose to comment on some parts of it. Brett, on the last podcast, the third one, Bill was starting to say something about defooing, or basically disconnecting from family of origin for those who are unfamiliar with the language. The conversation never developed, and I would love to hear his take on it. I got the initial impression that he was going to be negative, and I would like to hear more. I don't know that he is going to be negative, but I felt he might have more to say. Also, in this context, I would like to know what honor and duty means relative to a voluntary family. Do these coexist, and does he believe in the voluntary family?
My answer is I do believe in the voluntary family because of what I did having served in the legions most of my adult life and running into people who weren't my blood relation, but I became very close to as a result of circumstances that we were thrown into. And also, and you've seen this in education, sometimes there are folks who come to us who are the same age as our sons and daughters, and they come to us for mentorship, coaching, that kind of thing, and you develop a real close relationship with them. That's almost like family. Mm-hmm. So if that's how he's construing voluntary family relationships, I would say yay and verily. I think that's it's a terrific thing to do if you get the chance to bring somebody into your life and you take care of them like one of your children. I mean, I have some very dear friends for whom her sister had a child who she couldn't take care of, and she's adopted that child. And since that time, that she's raised her as her own. I have a stepson, my eldest son, who I've reared since he's been three, and he's my blood son. I don't like to use the term stepson or anything like that because I think it's derogatory. So I treat them all equally in that sense. As far as defooing, which means declaring yourself null and void from your family of origin, mm-hmm. there's a certain practitioner out there in the philosophical universe among libertarians who advocates this kind of thing, and I can't agree with him on that. I think it's destructive. And I also think that how can you say something like that philosophically and think that one size fits all? To me, I think that's the biggest construct in that entire apparatus that defies logic and virtue to me, is that you say, no matter what investment your parents made into you, good or bad, whatever it may be, let's say you had the worst parents, you had the best parents. Instantly, when you turn a majority age as recognized in America, you should turn your back on them and everything that they did for you? No, I don't agree with that at all.
And I don't think that – I hope nobody in that community would say it in such a way that was so across the board prescriptive. And what I've heard, and I've logged a lot of hours, you know, listening, is you should air your grievances. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That
nor do I.
If you feel like you were raised specifically in an abusive home, therapy would probably be a wise move. And you should, if you have a good therapist, and it might take a while to find one, you should raise that as a possibility. If your grievances are aired and the response you get from primarily, I would say, parents is, well, grow up, you know, toughen up. You know, I didn't do anything wrong, or I was a good provider, or the issue just is not addressed. There's no remorse. And of course, the treatment, even if once you reach the physical size of your parents, they don't beat you anymore, the emotional treatment does not improve. Why are you continuing some kind of, you know, unchosen positive obligation to those people? And, you know, there's been times where I've been really frustrated with some of the things that I've seen in my family, not even from my parents, you know, from a sibling. You know, I've tried to kind of weigh, and it's nothing that's like abusive towards me or even mean towards me. It has a lot to do with the treatment of children. And I, you know, I kind of weigh this, well, do I just disappear out of that person's life, or am I a positive influence? Is it better for me to just be there and be trying to encourage what I believe is right action? So
sure.
I've never put any serious consideration into disconnecting from either of my parents, but you know, I've looked at that history, and I would say the problems that I experienced growing up and the dysfunction in my family was relatively mild compared to some of the people who you know, wind up disconnecting completely.
Sure. So I guess we probably share the same conclusion then, is that it's a discretionary mechanism where if you feel that defooing from a particularly bad household, and I have experience with this, not with my children, but being a son, if that's the case, then maybe it would be, you know, meritorious to separate yourself from them. But to make that a blanket assignation where you say you should always defoo no matter how good your parentage was, I think it's destructive.
And I hope
because in the end, it's all you have.
Yeah. Yeah.
The blood is all you have.
It is. it was funny. My girlfriend and I were watching The Godfather, of all things, right? And I remember seeing it and I was like, oh, that's kind of a hokey notion about how, you know, how they treat family. And I'm even Italian, so I understand that there's a cultural impact there as well. But I remember seeing the movie, you know, a decade ago, 15 years ago, and kind of watching it with new eyes and having this whole collection of new experiences and challenges in life. And, you know, those were the people who were always there for me in the times that were the worst. And they never asked for anything in return. And there was even, in some cases, in some really difficult mistakes, I felt a withholding of judgment and acceptance. And I think that certainly counts for a lot to me.
I think it counts for a tremendous amount. And I also think that tangentially, it speaks to Burke's Democracy of the Dead, which is that there's a lot these little platoons, and it's used for homeschool moms especially, these little platoons do a lot of things and we can't quite grok why it works, but it works. And I think there's some of those mysteries with the family. Psychotherapists would have this conceit that they know otherwise, but I think I know almost intuitively that my final retreat will be with my family if times turn badly.
Yeah.
And I know that I'll be able to rely upon them to do the right thing. You know, we've had some, and I won't describe them on the air, but we've had some tough times with our children and the authorities on occasion. And we just had to buck up and do the right thing no matter what. And it paid off in the end. We had to do it. And that's what we did. And that's what families do.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is, I'm obviously against any kind of across the board prescription or recommendation for defooing. I think it's a case by case thing. And one of the attributes of, let's say, the Free Domain Radio call-in show, because that's where this has been most prevalent, at least in libertarian discussions over the last 5 years, people are calling in and participating in that a lot of the times, at least the most memorable ones, because they're in pretty desperate situations. It's not like somebody calls the show and the call screener says, well, have you defooed yet? I think it's a certain type of person or a certain type of situation that causes somebody to reach out for that kind of help or that kind of guidance. But if anybody in that community or elsewhere is trying to push it as an across the board thing, I could not disagree more. It doesn't even make any sense to me.
What astonishes me is the fatuousness and the fatal conceit and just the sheer presumption that somebody can call into your show and in 3 minutes you can prescribe to them precisely what's going to make their lives better after they hang up.
I agree, and I would want to know more about the preparation process, the screening process. Like, I know there's some adverse childhood experience tests that people are submitting prior to being on the show. And there have been times where I've listened and I felt like people were being pigeonholed. But other times I've listened and I felt like people were helped. So, but that's different. That is the challenge of trying to do that with strangers.
Yeah. And I approach it as a severe skeptic of the entire psychiatric, psychological, and psychotherapeutic culture.
Sure. Yeah.
If I hearken to anybody, it's Thomas Sasse, who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness and a number of other books, where he was rather libertarian in his outlook with this. And he saw at the time in the 60s when he wrote it, and now, of course, it's become almost a big pharma, big psychiatry, big government conclave, where they're almost getting to the point now of where they're saying, let's Sovietize this a bit. For instance, you and I probably have oppositional defiance disorder and syndrome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because we have a hard time with statist authority. And they'll probably find that in the desk manual someday, where they will make that an actionable offense and the state will use that and weaponize it so they can quell dissent.
Yeah, I remember a couple times when I was younger seeking this out, like wanting to go and talk to somebody about issues that I was having. And I get a lot of valuable insights, but I was incredibly lucky, considering at the time I was in my early 20s and I knew nothing of this world, you know, that you're describing right now, this complex that's developed. I didn't learn about this until just a couple years later when I was working in that residential school. And I,
you know what? Yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
I had one experience when I was about 21. I went and saw somebody, and it was 21, 22, around that time, went on for about a year. And it was an incredible experience. And it was an eye-opening, amazing transformation in my early life. And I got a lot of really valuable insights that, of course, I still remember to this day and that I built on
sure.
to this day. A few years later, I went back, and the problem was anxiety-related. I don't think I was there for half an hour before the prescription book was out. And I didn't know anything then, but I knew that wasn't right. You know, I knew that wasn't the right thing to do. So,
yeah.
But I mean, I could have been sucked into an entirely different world. I was fortunate that in my 30s, I came across the work of Nathaniel Brandon, who does come from that world, but is also, for what it's worth, libertarian and in many ways objectivist. The good things, I think, about objectivism. And he says, you know, this is something that you can take control of. This is something that, you know, you can be the author of. Brandon does this thing with sentence stems where basically you're trying to tap into the subconscious. So he'll have a prompt and then you just try to write as many endings as possible. So you're kind of doing a self-therapy. Now, that could be supplemental to actual therapy. But what's really important about it is you're not going to somebody else the way you go to a mechanic. You are an active participant in this process in a way that a mechanic would find annoying.
Sure. And I find, for instance, with my wife's a nutritionist, I find when I do just the opposite of what the FDA and the Department of Agriculture tells me to do, I'm healthier.
Mm, that is true.
What concerns me the most about defooing and the psychotherapy culture that is championed by certain people in the libertarian sphere, the blogosphere, is that to a certain extent, they're playing into the hands of the state by embracing the state's means of alleviating or solving problems, which in this case, using an external source, which would be Big Pharma, or paying very large billable hours for friends to listen to you bloviate about certain things, in that that's the solution. The catharsis is the speaking and not the action. So those things really concern me about that, among which, of course, is that I find if you do the opposite of what the state wants you to do, you'll always be healthier.
Follow-up question. I scrolled all the way back to, let's see, let me get a date here. November 24th, Patrick, or PTRCK on Facebook. I'd be curious to know how Stoicism can be employed in marriages, romantic relationships, and family relations, specifically to make them more beneficial. How does a Stoic handle conflict in relationships to achieve a more win-win situation?
You know, I'll have to consider that. And I think when it comes to romantic notions, it would be hard to find in Stoicism and Epictetism versus Epicureanism and Hedonism those things that would benefit. But I do think what would accrue to a closer family and friend relationship are some of the Stoic virtues of duty, honor, fidelity. When one takes out a contract, you honor that contract. For instance, as illustration, Bill Clinton comes out during his presidency and reveals that he was unfaithful to his wife. And people say, but that's his personal life and not his public life.
Mm-hmm.
To which a Stoic would respond, if you can't trust a man's behavior to the one he pledges the most fidelity, how can you trust him in anything he does at all?
That's such a good point.
Right? So
yeah, the fact that those people are still in business is astonishing to me.
It's astonishing to me.
If you want to call that business.
Yeah. I think that's something of a conundrum when he mentioned romance, because that's a consistent problem for I'm an Aspie. I have Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the autistic spectrum. And people on the autistic spectrum tend to have problems with romance to a larger extent, I think, than most folks.
Sure.
Because I'm not neurotypical. I'm neuroatypical, according to my spouse. So You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to yield to superior wisdom from others who can speak to the relationship between Stoicism and romance, and I will abide by what I just said, that there are Stoic attributes that can make a marriage more fulfilling, accepting that, if that answers the question.
Absolutely. I think there's something to be said for being prepared for conflict or friction. You know, sometimes these things come up in relationships, and a lot of the time I think what people do is they push that stuff down, right? So when it finally does come up, there's a whole resentment, you know, tagging along with it. And it's not about win-win anymore. When an issue comes up and it's got some, you know, old kind of moldy resentment attached to it, it's very much often reframed as win-lose. So being willing to face conflict when it happens constructively, I think minimizes the amount of resentments that may come up in a relationship that lead to those win-lose frameworks for interaction, which are always pretty caustic and counterproductive.
I'd like to offer you a genius prize, because genius has often been described as the combination of disparate things together for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I think you've come upon something here where you say that if you approach, I'm an economist by training, if you approach romance from an economist's perspective and you say it's not a zero-sum solution, you may be able to accrue some benefits from that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you, not me. So thanks for that, Brett.
My pleasure. And we have our last question. I've been scrolling around here looking for how it was originally asked. It was asked by a listener named Sarah. We addressed it a little bit on one of the earlier shows. She was curious as to what you meant about women being less willing or even perhaps less able to embrace the philosophy of liberty. And I felt like it was my fault when we originally addressed this question. We moved through it very quickly and on to a conversation about how good Jeffrey Tucker looks. So I felt like as I was leading the conversation, I led to it being dismissed. But I wanted to just give that a little bit more time here at the end. The lack of women in libertarianism.
You know what? I have to say, when I made that comment, I wasn't referring to libertarianism. I was referring to abolitionism.
Mm-hmm.
I was referring to anarchism. And what I've discovered is that there is a huge gender gap, which I hope will be remedied, or I hope that somebody proves me wrong, that for every – and this is anecdotal – for every 100 abolitionists or anarchists that I meet, zero government folks that I meet, I'm lucky to find one or two women who subscribe to that. And please, I'd like your audience to forgive me. This is anecdotal. It certainly isn't something where I've discovered that statistically I can prove this to be the case. Are there well-literate and articulate female individualists out there like Wendy McElroy? There's no doubt in my mind. And I'm certain we can find others. But for every Wendy McElroy, there's going to be a dozen or two dozen male writers of the same pedigree and talent who are out there exposing and expositing these views. So that's where I come to that. And I think it's a tragedy because, of course, women are 50% of the population. Of course, folks out there can probably theorize on, well, why is there this gender gap in anarchy and abolitionism? I don't have all the answers. For me, it's simply an observation more so than anything else.
Yeah. You know, I've never really liked the question because – and it's not the exact question Sarah was asking. But, you know, this is a question that's been floated everywhere in blogs and on Facebook. Like, why aren't there more women anarchists? First of all, in the big scheme of things, almost no one has accepted these ideas. Almost all people are conformists. And it makes me wonder if it's like really time to break away from that problem to focus on the disparity between men and women in the philosophy of liberty or abolitionism or anarchy, right? Because some
– and I'll leave that to the – is it the thickest? Is that the thick libertarians?
The ones with the most comprehensive treatment, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to because I'm the thinnest of libertarians, if I'm employing the argot correctly, in which I don't bother myself with class, gender, anything like that. I'm just all about 100% liberty.
Absolutely.
Because there's a thin versus thick dichotomy out there with left people who call themselves left market libertarians and such.
Yeah.
I'm just a plain old abolitionist. I think that the ownership of other human beings is wrong no matter how you slice it.
I think, too, that abolitionism or anarchism comes from first being, in many cases for many people, a minarchist.
Here's what I'm told, and maybe you've got better figures. I'm told that 95% of all libertarians are minarchist and that 5% are anarchist and abolitionist.
I don't have anything to counter that, but I mean, it contradicts my experience here in New Hampshire in the Free State Project, where everyone I see almost is an anarchist. But in the
now,
broader
I'll
picture,
tell you this though, yeah, having been to the Free State Project several times, is that 10 years ago you go to Freedom Fest, and I urge your audience to go to Freedom Fest if you get a chance, in Pork Fest, and the is it the Liberty Council that they have in February or March?
Liberty Forum is usually in February or March.
Forum.
Yeah.
And of course, Porkfest in June, which is a hoot and a great time. But 10 years ago, you would have swung a dead cat, and I love cats, so I hate saying that, but you would have swung a dead cat and hit minarchist every which way. Now you swing that same cat and you're hitting anarchist every which way.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a sea change in the last 10 years as far as the sheer number of anarchists / abolitionists versus minarchist. So I think you're right.
The other thing, too, is that if we just focus on minarchy for a second, the philosophy of liberty for most people, I would say a good portion of people, is political first, right? It was, I think it really was for me, like the whole Ron Paul thing. Even before Ron Paul, it was always like framed around political issues. And I wonder how women have felt, maybe I have no idea, but I can't imagine it's terribly positive, over the last 40 years about the political arena. Do they feel like there's a place for them in that? Why would they? You know?
Well, you know, I run ZeroGov.com.
Yeah.
And I have a book titled ZeroGov, Limited Government, Unicorns and Other Mythological Creatures.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much self-explanatory that I consider myself to be apolitical, and I consider any statist politics to be poisonous to the advancement of liberty and freedom in any fashion whatsoever.
Right.
I'm a non-voter. I don't think that process works, parliamentary and congressional, whatever the case may be. You come up with whatever your political system is. Eventually, I think it will corrode individual freedom and liberty at the for the expansion of the state every time. There is no exception to that historically. So I'm a moral abolitionist and a consequentialist abolitionist, as Bradford would tell us from Liberty Magazine a dozen years ago. I'm a moral abolitionist because of what I just said about being opposed to the ownership of other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also a consequentialist abolitionist because of my economic training as an Austrian economist. And I know that a free society always accrues extraordinary benefits to everybody across the board who's willing to participate in cooperation, nonviolence, and persuasion.
Absolutely. And it's just, I think most people don't get there, you know? Well, I mean, almost all people don't get there, but even people who identify as libertarian might not get there, you know?
We've got, you know, Nick Gillespie, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Great fella, very articulate, with the Reason Foundation, does terrific work, but he's a committed minarchist.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, when I look at minarchist, I say to myself, but limited government is impossible. No one has shown me where once you give these psychopaths the saddle and the reins that they don't stop. They never stop.
Right.
Well, they don't stop until you're dead, because that's another vision that I have, is that all politics is a death cult. And if you don't think that's the case, ask the men and women in America who are constantly assaulted on a consistent basis daily for illegal vegetation, not having a seatbelt on, not driving at an arbitrary set of numbers that's on a sign at the side of the road that doesn't happen to match their speedometer, or whatever the case may be. In the end, when that cockroach stops you, he will kill you for your level of noncompliance if we reach the points he decides that's the case.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if there's anything we can add to this, so I feel like we gave it the thought it deserves. You know, I thought about this from like an evolutionary psychology standpoint. I thought about it from the political standpoint. I mean, a lot of the best answers that I could come up with as far as why the numbers skew so significantly men to women in anarchism, the idea that it's political first, and how are most people in this country introduced to politics? I know where I was introduced to it, college. You know, it's like, hi, we're the left. Welcome to politics. Oh, you're a white male, so you and you come from like a middle class background. All right, you can move along. Hi, everybody else. We're the left, that's and right. we're here to that's put right. you into groups and explain to you yeah. why you're victims. I remember how young, impressionable, and naive I was at 18, 19, 20 years old being introduced to politics. A lot of people who come from a place where maybe the message of the left resonates more with them, maybe they get stuck there. And maybe a lot of women are in that group. I can't see how that wouldn't be the case. I mean, almost everybody is naive in this political versus abolitionist world. So especially with what we see today in feminism, and this was my problem with the way I dealt with the question before, I felt like I seamlessly connected a question about women generally to feminism, which was missing a lot of steps. But if you look at the gravity that it has in today's political conversation, I don't think it can be overlooked.
One direction we can go here is that John Lott drafted a paper on women's suffrage right. and the size of government, mm-hmm. in which he did the countywide analysis and census. And if I may quote from it, he says, giving women the right to vote dramatically changed American politics from the very beginning. Despite claims to the contrary, the gender gap is not something that has arisen since the 70s. It coincided with immediate dramatic increases in state government expenditures of revenue, and these effects continued growing as more women took advantage of the franchise. Now, he goes on, and you can read the entire 75-page peer-reviewed, footnoted paper, but it's a pretty sad conclusion yeah. that he comes to. Now, is it correlative or causative? I think it's a mix of both. I think it's more correlative than causative, which in my mind means that it's a less powerful indictment than if it were causative. But I just think there's a lot to be said that there's a difference between the sexes, and I find myself to be a sexist in this society, in the 21st century America, because I'll open doors for women, I will pull out chairs, I'll do that kind of thing. And I make a distinction both psychologically and physically between men and women, and accept that I don't say that men are superior to women. What I say is that they're different. Now, I'm indicted for that in modern day America, because you're not supposed to think that way. But Lott comes the closest to me in almost either statistically or empirically showing that a woman's intuitive need and sense for security, especially by using the state as a proxy thereof, is it. You can find it in this paper, for instance. But I would welcome your audience, especially women in your audience, to prove me wrong.
It makes sense to me. There's a good article that people could check out. It's called Why Aren't More Women Libertarians by Pamela Stubart. And she talks a little bit about evolutionary psychology in that article. And I'm not an expert, so I don't want to get too into it here. But if you look at what has been sold to people, because I think the two work together. I think the message and the propaganda could work with evolutionary psychology. And a lot of the best female candidates we could have for libertarianism, even a lot of the best male candidates we could have for libertarian anarchism, abolitionism, they might have already been bought off by the government. With the message, the state is the answer to your problems. How pervasive is that in the 21st century for young women? The state is the answer to your problems. So if they believe that uncritically, if we just, you know, put that aside, it's almost to their credit that it makes sense that most wouldn't be in favor of throwing that away.
K through 12 is a mind laundry.
Yeah.
To morph people into this Prussian imperial conditioning. And all the universities are simply finishing schools for that collectivist software that's installed in their heads and all the rationalizations that attend that. And until you and I and Charles Murray convince more people that not everybody should go to college, this collectivist supremacism, this government supremacism among all demographics is going to continue apace.
I absolutely agree. You know, Bill, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. I don't know what this will translate to in recording time, but we've been at it for 2 hours and 40 minutes, and I'm so appreciative of your time and all the value that you've added to the program. And I'm ready to tell the listeners that this is something that I definitely have a strong desire to do once a month. There was another question that we're not going to get to today about, I shouldn't even say what it is, but it was about psychological warfare. That's something we could do a whole show about. So
we could do a whole show
on
that,
you know, sometime in the future.
Well, look, Brett, as I said, it's an honor to be on your show. I think that you are doing a show that is for the ages, because 100 years from now, I'm hoping, and not just listening to Bill Buport, but listening to Thaddeus Russell and all the other great minds that you bring on board, complemented by yours, of course. This is the long now. You're establishing a foundational workshop and toolkit so that when people are ready to liberate themselves, they'll have a repository to go to give them guidelines.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm trying to tell the folks. All right, Bill. Well, I appreciate it so much, and I look forward to having you on again soon.
Thanks a lot. I look forward to hearing from you. Sweet memories.